Hello and welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And again, I'm in the studio in Berkeley, and the reason I'm here and not coming to you from the other side of the continent is that I've just finished up a week as a media fellow at the Hoover Institution, the right-wing think tank based at Stanford. The Hoover Institution was founded in 1919 by the future president, Herbert Hoover, who I believe was the first student admitted to that university on its founding. Hoover has a huge archives of a lot of right-wing material, Friedrich Hayek, Milton Friedman, the publisher Henry Regnery, as well as a lot of left and socialist stuff, including Trotsky's papers. I believe they're trying to get Stalin's papers as well. I want to get to the bottom of that. Their fellows include some fairly obscure academics, as well as right-wing celebrities like Ed Meese and Condoleezza Rice. I was told that much of the support staff, the female support staff there, are actually liberal Democrats, perhaps in reaction to all that exposure to right-wing savants. And curiously, I was also told that about half of the fellows, despite their right-wing affiliations, reported for voted for Obama in 2008, since they hated Bush so much. Big spender and all that. But also, one of the fellows, whom we'll hear from next week, Morris Fiorina, told me that most of them oppose the invasion of Iraq. And the more I hear about that decision to invade Iraq, the less I understand why exactly we did it. If right-wing savants and some of the funders of the Hoover Institution as well were opposed to it, what was going on? Anyway, today will consist, I'll have a bunch of interviews, or a couple of interviews, with those fellows, and then also some more in the coming weeks. First up, Paul Gregory, who's a specialist in the former Soviet Union, who now follows contemporary Russia. Here he is, talking about the contest between Vladimir Putin and Dmitry Medvedev for the presidency of Russia. Paul Gregory.
Russia's got an election coming up. When is the election?
2012.
So we've got a long campaign season ahead of us.
Correct.
But the whole Putin-Medvedev thing never made sense to me in the first place. I mean, it was always assumed that Putin was going to be the power behind the throne, but give a guy power and he's not going to want somebody behind him. Did it ever make sense to you from the outset, this arrangement?
Well, we cannot look inside the Kremlin. It was always felt that Putin would remain the number one guy and Medvedev would be his puppet. But when you give a puppet a position that carries with it considerable power, the puppet decides he no longer wants to be a puppet. So I think that's the situation we are in right now.
Well, what is the division of powers between the president and the prime minister? What are the formal relations here?
The powers are defined by the so-called Yeltsin Constitution, which created a very powerful presidency. At the time the Constitution was passed, there was great concern about a return of the Communist Party to power. So they made the position of president extremely powerful. The greatest power the president has is the power to dismiss the government at any time. And if the parliament goes against the recommendation of the president to dissolve the government and fire the prime minister, a general election has to be held. So this is the major source of power of the Russian president. And this power is in the hands of Medvedev right now.
So how have things worked out between the two of them so far?
Well, I think that for about the first year and a half, things worked the way Putin expected. Medvedev did not take an independent stand on things. It was rather clear that Putin was the guy in charge. But in the last year, Medvedev has really set out his own agenda, which is quite different from Putin's. These agendas have to be set out very carefully and very subtly. So rarely do the two come into conflict. But Medvedev has really identified himself as the more pro-Western of the two. more interested in integration into the world economy. He's much more concerned about the absence of a rule of law. He speaks openly about the problems of corruption. So he's taken a position which is almost the exact opposite to Putin. But as I say, they are very subtle in how they lay these platforms out.
Putin, at least in the early days, was perceived by some as someone who put a stop to the decline of Russia. And you know, this is a country, an economy, a society that was in collapse. And to all appearances, Putin arrested that and turned it around. Do you agree with that diagnosis?
It's difficult to say. Putin came into power in late 1999, and the economy turned around in 1998. So he was the beneficiary of a recovery that was already underway. But he did come in at a time when things were still very chaotic. Pensions were not being paid. There was great dissatisfaction. And so he did make a reputation among the people for restoring some sense of sanity to the economy. And as a reward for this, his popularity ratings soar, and his popularity ratings are still quite high. And indeed, in Putin's early years, everything he said made a lot of sense. You know, he wanted reform, he wanted stability, and
he wanted to crack down on the oligarchs.
Well, not initially. When he first came in, the deal was that he would let the oligarchs keep their wealth as long as they behaved. So he reversed that position when he went after Khodorkovsky. And as you may know, Khodorkovsky's appeal was denied yesterday, which is, I think, a major event in Russia. But in general, I would say that Putin's first 3-4 years were very positive. And what he did was correct. He said the right things. My suspicion is that what happened was that he got caught up in corruption and greed. And he appointed his friends from the KGB days to the most important positions in the economy. So if you look at the sort of direction of corruption, it was not too bad when he first entered office, but it is quite bad now.
And what was his contribution to that, do you think?
Well, I'm convinced he's personally very corrupt. It's very tempting to be corrupt in this society because you've had privatizations, you're able to take property away from people you don't particularly like and award the property and positions to people you do like. I think the term KGB state is quite appropriate because if you look at the people who are in positions of authority now, they are former KGB people.
And it's also, they used a lot of like tax investigations to shut down media they didn't like, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, has that continued under Medvedev?
Well, you have to remember that Putin, as prime minister, is really responsible for running the government. Medvedev, as president, is responsible for foreign policy and overseeing things, but the practical running of the government is in Putin's hands. The thing that is different in this so-called tandem between Putin and Medvedev is that usually when things go wrong, the president fires the prime minister and gets another prime minister. So this is the first term in which there have not been a number of firings of prime ministers. And Medvedev does have the power and authority to fire Putin if he so wishes.
And why hasn't he? Is it too much of a power base, too much popularity with the broad public? Or
Putin is popular. Medvedev is popular as well. We don't know what would happen if Medvedev fired Putin, because Putin is the head of the United Russia Party, which has virtually all the seats in parliament. There are impeachment procedures. So if Medvedev fired Putin, that would test constitutional waters. And no one really knows what would happen.
So it'd be a big mess.
Be a big mess, yeah.
So in the run-up to the election, how do you see these two guys competing? Are they going to run directly head-to-head?
Well, we don't know how it's done because there is no formal procedure. It is terribly confusing right now because no one really knows who the top dog is. In terms of constitutional power, Medvedev is top dog. In terms of real power, Putin is top dog. There will only be one candidate. So somehow this is going to have to be resolved, and we have no idea how this will be resolved. If you remember the term smoke-filled rooms, this is the ultimate smoked-filled room with the door locked.
And they, so still, we have they still smoke a lot there, not like that.
Yes, yes.
Now, the way you portray this, is this kind of a battle between a candidate that is more pleasing to the West versus one that's not so. Is that
correct?
Fair?
Mm-hmm.
So Medvedev, for example, might want to join the WTO?
Correct.
And Putin wouldn't?
Putin is ambiguous.
Why would he not want to join?
He's ambiguous because his line is that the state should protect the Russian farmer, it should protect Russian industry. If you're in the World Trade Organization, you have to follow all these liberalization rules. He thinks the role of the state is to protect industry, not to subject it to the vagaries of international markets. But he's ambiguous on this. And Medvedev is not ambiguous. He says, we would like to be members of the WTO.
Is Putin working with some sort of model of an Asian-style developmental state?
I don't know if Putin really has a model.
Or is he just trying to hand out subsidies to his friends?
I think that's more, that's closer to the truth.
More like Latin America than South
Well,
Korea.
He does talk about, let me take back what I said, because Putin's model is really a model of very strong industrial policy. So he's saying we should place our bets with big state-owned enterprises like Gazprom, which is the largest oil and gas company, or Transneft, or Rosneft. So we need to pick these national champions. We need to give them what they need. So his model is somewhat of an Asian industrial policy model, whereas Medvedev's is more of a sort of open economy, free-for-all, which is an exaggeration of the position, in which you let high-tech businesses sort of bubble up through entrepreneurial energy and so forth. So their visions are quite different. Let me say that, like in the U.S., they're speaking about platforms which are not going to be enacted. So it's just, in reality, the differences are not that great, but in setting out their positions, there are these rather stark differences.
I'm speaking with Paul Gregory at the Hoover Institution. I would imagine that there are a lot of established Russian industrialists who don't want to hear anything about opening up. That would be frightening to them.
Correct.
So Putin would then have a lot of very powerful support.
Correct.
What about the structure of the Russian economy over the last decade or so? Have they diversified beyond the primary sector, or is it still really about oil and natural resources?
If one were to grade Putin, because Putin has been really in charge since late 1999, I would imagine the evaluation would be that his greatest failure has been the lack of diversification. So this is an energy economy, and it lives or dies on the basis of energy and energy prices. And this is really what Medvedev is attacking Putin on. He's saying, you know, we can't simply be an energy economy. We have to have high tech. We have to have this. We have to have that. So there has really been very little diversification.
They seem to have some very skilled scam artists who are operating in the cyber world.
They are perhaps the best in the world on this.
Yeah, but they haven't been able to put that to honest use yet.
No.
How much has the Russian recovery of the last decade or so been dependent upon the fact that oil is now $100 a barrel?
If you do a chart, there's a very strong correlation. What's disturbing now and may be contributing to the slight declines in Putin's popularity ratings is that oil prices are going this way and the economy is going, still going down, or really not recovering. So this linkage between the oil price and economic performance has not been very evident in the last year or so.
Medvedev, as you describe him, sounds like another one of these Russian liberals that Westerners love that really doesn't go anywhere in Russian politics. That's not really popular with either the Russian elite or the Russian masses. Is he going to be another one like that we heard many of in the 90s?
I think that Medvedev would like to be, like to serve a second term. If he's basing his hopes on a liberal base, the liberal base is very small. Putin's base is very large. Therefore, irrespective of what he wants to do, I don't think he will be president. If he were president, his, by some surprise, he would not have much support because the percentage of sort of liberal thinking Russians is very low. However, if you ask me, if you ask my opinion, the biggest problem Russia has is corruption. You know, and he at least is willing to speak out on corruption. Putin is not willing to speak out on corruption. So anyone who can moderate the corruption problem will be successful. But as you know, once corruption is entrenched, it's very difficult to remove.
It just becomes part of daily life, and
yeah.
People shrug their shoulders.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
This is a country also where at least a substantial minority of the population has somewhat fond memories of Stalin, isn't it?
Unfortunately, as I recall the numbers, about 2 years ago, some one-third of the population spoke favorably or rated Stalin favorably.
Is that just the older people, or is it?
Yeah, they're the skinheads, and I don't know how many skinheads there are, but the older people think fondly of Stalin. For a long time, Putin himself was ambiguous about Stalin.
Well, he certainly liked to play the strong man, though.
Yeah, he likes the idea of the strong man, but if you look at what Putin did, he went back in history and tried to find other strong men, like Peter the Great, or like Stolypin, or you know, some of the great...
less controversial despots.
Well, you know, there were some fairly good prime ministers under the czars, some liberal, some emancipators and so forth. So they really tried to find someone other than Stalin, but Stalin is the one the people remember. So Putin was ambiguous for very long.
Now, how do you see this Russians in the near future dealing with things like the intervention in Libya? Or will they go along with what the United States and NATO want? Or will they block them in the UN? Or are they just going to hang back?
Medvedev is going to be more positive towards the West, but only slightly so. I think there is something of unanimity within the Russian leadership that... they face possible encirclement. So these old fears of encirclement.
Are they worried about China as well?
They should. Whether they are, I can't say, but they worry about Georgia, they worry about Ukraine being picked off by the West. So these fears of encirclement are shared by Medvedev and Putin. I think a big difference is that Putin kind of likes being an irritant to the West. I don't know if Medvedev likes being an irritant that much. And so Putin will supply nuclear technology to Iran. Medvedev would be less likely to do so. So, but I think fundamentally they're not that different.
So right now, how would you handicap the battle between the two?
If you asked me this question a year ago, I would have said Putin for sure. It is slightly less certain now, but I would give like 4-1 that Putin will be the next president.
All right. We'll come back at you.
Okay. Remember, election day is meaningless. There'll be one party. There'll be one real party and a lot of insignificant parties. So it's the nomination that counts. Uh-huh. It's not the election. So the nomination could be decided within a month, for all I know.
And that was the voice of Paul Gregory, who is a fellow at the Hoover Institution, where I spent a week as a media fellow. And he, not one of the scary fellows over there, but we'll hear from one of those in a moment. Let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to hear about school reform.
Wake up, boy! This is your life! Come on, son! Well, the five principles always in your face, telling you what to do. That brainless wit can kiss my ass, never, never.
And that a bit of Mojo Nixon doing High School as a Prison to set up the next interview. My previous guest from the Hoover Institution was a pretty sensible guy, at least what we talked about. He is a climate change denialist, but we didn't discuss that. Next guest is a bit more on the scary side. Terry Moe, a professor of political science at Stanford and a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. His most recent book is Special Interest, Teachers, Unions, and America's Public Schools. He's against them, as you'll soon hear. A book was published by the Brookings Institution, a place where he was a fellow in the late 80s, and made a major contribution to the so-called school reform movement, that is, charter schools, vouchers, heavy testing, union busting, and the like. An agenda that's become now very familiar, but he was one of the founders of it. Brookings, where he was then, was usually thought of as a think tank dominated by Democrats, but as with the deregulation movement of the 1970s, an agenda that Brookings also played a big part in conjunction with right-wing think tanks, school reform has now become a fully bipartisan affair. Towards the end of this interview, you'll hear Mo say kind things about Obama and his education secretary, Arne Duncan, something that should give Democrats and friends of labor serious pause. Terry Mo.
So you are no fan of the teachers' unions. Give us a brief version of your indictment of the beast.
Well, you know, I don't know that I would start it off that way as an indictment.
Critique.
I think the teachers' unions are by far the most powerful force in American education, and I think that they have enormous influences on the way our schools are organized. They do it from the bottom up through collective bargaining contracts that are filled with all sorts of rules that really are, in many ways, the organization of schooling. You know, when we have seniority provisions for transfers or for layoffs, when we have pay schedules that have nothing to do with performance, those things are specified in contracts, and they are the organization of schooling. So a lot of the organization of schooling is shaped directly by the unions and by their power and by their interests. And then they also shape the schools from the top down through politics, through the political process, where important decisions are made about programs and policies in education, but above all else, this is where decisions are made about education reform. And this nation has been trying to reform the schools for over a quarter century, and the unions have used their power to block or weaken major reforms because they find these reforms threatening. So here we are after a quarter century. You know, and we're still saying the schools need to be reformed. And the big reason is that this whole era has been a huge disappointment. We've made very little progress, and a big part of the reason is the unions have blocked things.
What percentage of American teachers are represented by unions?
Well, it depends upon what figures you use. I think that it's somewhere in the ballpark of 80%, 79%.
Now, there's some states where they're not very significant forces. Or in some way
I would say in general that's not true. The way to look at it is that their power varies across the states, and it can vary significantly. So in the southern and border states, they're not as powerful as they are in New York and California and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and Ohio and those sorts of industrial states. But on the other hand, even in the southern states, they are or can be quite powerful.
But in several of the southern states, collective bargaining agreements are prohibited, aren't they?
Yes. In about seven states, collective bargaining for teachers is prohibited.
Now, when I looked at the data, I looked at some of the test scores myself and the rankings where they come up on the NAEP tests. And I found no relation at all between, a slightly negative relation between the prevalence of collective bargaining agreements and test outcomes. So do you see that there is one?
Yes. And why would you expect to be able to eyeball it and just say, you know, compare test scores to collective bargaining and think that you're going to be able to detect a causal relationship, right? That's the most basic kind of thing that you don't want to do. Now, there are many, many factors that determine student achievement. I think collective bargaining is one of them. The South has traditionally had low test scores, right, for a variety of reasons. I think that if they had full-blown collective bargaining, their test scores would probably be even lower than they are now. But, you know, we can't determine that. But you certainly don't want to jump to any conclusions just based on a simple correlation.
Well, it does seem that the best predictor of educational outcomes, test scores, or however you want to measure them, is child poverty rates.
Absolutely.
And how does collective bargaining fit into that?
Well, I think the way to think of it is that there are many factors that determine student achievement. The student's family background, socioeconomic status, whether the parents are married, those sorts of things have a huge impact. They are the most important set of factors that determine how much kids learn. But what education reformers and what the states and the federal government can most control when it comes to education reform is the quality of the schools. And so the schools can add something to these kids' lives and make an independent contribution over and above student background. Right? So I think what we want to do is to have the schools be as good as they can possibly be so that all kids learn as much as they can possibly learn. But it is true that disadvantaged kids are literally disadvantaged when they come to school.
And how much difference can the schools make? I mean, what evidence do you have that they can make a profound difference?
There are, for instance, really great charter schools that have focused on disadvantaged kids and had enormous success with them. The KIPP schools are the best known, I think. There are also schools in Harlem that are attracting huge followings because of the test score gains that the kids there have made. The Harlem Children's Zone, run by Jeffrey Canada, Harlem Success,
which also spends a lot of money,
but money is not the key to the whole thing.
Well, it gets a lot of money from Wall Street hedge fund guys too. That can't hurt, can it?
I don't think money ever hurts, but I think it would be wrong to jump to the conclusion that it's because they have a lot of money that they're successful. I think these kids are. I mean, these schools are doing things differently.
What's different that you admire and want to replicate?
Well, I think the most important thing for starters is that they're free to do whatever they want to do to help these kids. They're literally designing their schools around the needs of these kids. And so their teachers, like the KIPP teachers, they don't just work a typical school day. They work longer. They also go to work on Saturday. The kinds of the structure of these schools, the way they're organized, is completely different from the regular public schools. The teachers are not unionized. They're not the schools are not buried in all these restrictions with having to do with seniority and all the rest. And so they have total flexibility in designing schools in ways that get these kids to learn, and they've been quite successful.
Now, nationally, I mean, the consensus of the studies I've read, and I've read some of the literature, is that the evidence on charters is at best mixed. Some are good, some are bad, some are better, some are worse. But there's no conclusive evidence that they are significantly better than traditional public schools. Do you disagree with that?
I think there are studies and there are studies, but in general, I would say that's fair. That characterization is fair. And I think it's important to step back and ask, well, what would we expect? You know, I think what we want is to let a thousand flowers bloom and allow schools to spring up in response to the demands and needs of parents and students and see which ones work. And not all of them are going to work. It's like, in the marketplace, you wouldn't expect every business to be good. There are a lot of businesses that are bad, and so what you want in a well-working marketplace is for the bad ones to go out of business. Now, this is not exactly analogous to an economic marketplace. So
this is a bit of human experimentation on kids, isn't it?
Well, compared to what? If you live in Harlem, you're going to crummy public schools, really bad public schools. So to say that it's an experiment to give these kids the option to go to the charter schools that are dedicated to serving them, that is not an experiment. Well, it's an effort to get these kids out of truly bad, demonstrably bad situations. But I think we should talk about the quality of the charter schools that you brought
up.
Okay,
sure.
Because I think charter school supporters, and I'm a charter school supporter, would say, look, you're going to have some bad schools. And we have to expect that. So what we need to do is design the system in such a way that if we identify bad schools, they can be shut down. They need to be shut down, right? So I would say most charter school supporters are very much in favor of shutting down bad schools. They have no tolerance for bad schools. Also, I think that charter schools are very different one from another. And if you look at some of the studies that have claimed that charter schools, like, aren't as good as public schools or whatever, the Credo study is the best
known of them. Yeah, that's one of the people.
If you look inside that study and just read it, right, it turns out that it demonstrates what we already know, which is that when kids are in their first year at a charter school, when they've just come into a charter school, they're brand new, they're not going to do as well as kids in the regular public schools. It turns out that because the charter school movement is growing and there are more new schools, in the Credo study, more than half the kids were in their first year. And those were the kids that didn't do as well as the kids in the regular public schools. The second year kids did at least as well as kids in the regular public school, and the third year kids did quite a bit better than the kids in the regular public schools.
Well, the charter can also kick out people that they don't like, right? I mean, Jeffrey Canada fired a whole grade of.
I think it's wrong to say that it's a selection explanation, that somehow these are special kids. I think in many cases these are kids who were failing, who were disgruntled, dissatisfied, doing poorly in their regular public schools. The charter schools have a very diverse set of kids that they're dealing with, and in many districts. Districts only give them charters because they're willing to take kids that the districts are happy to get rid of. So you can't say that somehow these are the kids who are destined to succeed in the charter. It's just not true.
Now, I have a kid who's about to enter the New York City public school system, and navigating the whole world of school choice is extremely complicated and daunting. Mm-hmm. And actually, I don't know how a lot of parents who are not affluent and educated as we are can handle this the complexities of the choice system. It expects a lot of the parents. Parents make decisions based on very incomplete evidence. How in this world of competitive choice can parents be relied upon to make really good choices for their
okay,
kids?
Okay, I think it's important to give people responsibility over their own lives and not to be patronizing. These parents in Harlem know one thing, that if their kids are going to a regular public school, that regular public school in many cases is terrible. And they don't want their kids in that school. And as a result, the Harlem charter schools, which are capped at about, you know, there are very few of them, and they can only take in about 2,000 kids They have a wait list of 11,000 kids. Why is that? It's because parents know that their own schools are crummy. And parents don't have to be rocket scientists to figure this out. And they talk to other parents, right? Schools develop reputations. People do get informed. Now, not all parents are going to get well informed. But in my view, if we're going to construct a good, well-functioning choice system, we should have parent information centers. We should require parents to go in there and get well-informed, or guardians or whatever, right? We should set this up so that parents are the best possible decision makers. But even as it is now, to say that parents aren't fully informed is not a justification for dooming those kids to stay in terrible schools.
Well, the major reason that they're terrible schools is the populations are very poor and the infrastructure surrounding them is in terrible shape.
But there are schools right there in Harlem that are great, right? But filled with poor kids.
Well, but the Jeffrey Canada has, you know, what, a budget
it's
much
larger.
It's
not the money. This is sort of a knee-jerk kind of reaction that it must be something else. It can't be that people who are free to construct their own schools around the needs of poor kids can actually do it. But they can do it.
You are a proponent of technology in schools, right? Virtual
yes.
learning.
Huh?
What is the advantage of that? Is there evidence that this improves outcomes or does it just save money?
Well, I think the way to look at it is that this is the beginning of a revolution and we're right at the beginning of it. And so what we're seeing, which is already very impressive, we can talk about it, is a primitive version of what it's going to look like in 10 years or 20 years. Okay, so what does it look like now? What it looks like now is that kids can take a whole curriculum if they want, or one class, whatever, on the computer. So if you want to take third grade math or eighth grade algebra, or 10th grade history, or chemistry, or biology, or Mandarin, or you know, whatever it is you want to take, you can take it on the computer. And when you do, these things are pretty sophisticated already, very sophisticated. It's customized to you, right? It's interactive between you and the computer. So as you move through the material, it's all based on what you know, right? You can't just sit in a chair for a semester and get through the course. You actually have to know the stuff and move through it. And as you move through it, the computer knows what you know and what you don't know. And these things, in many cases, are designed to make adjustments as you move through so that when you don't know stuff, the computer knows you don't know and gives you remedial help on those kinds of issues, right, until you do know them, and then you move back on track. And so the whole thing is about you. It's customized to you. And this truly allows education, big picture, to be customized to the individual child. It's the most exciting thing that has ever hit education. It's gonna revolutionize education all around the world. Kids are gonna get a customized education to them. No more of this sitting in a classroom staring out the window.
Now, do we have evidence of the kinds of outcomes that these experiments produce?
Yeah, I mean,
now, I just read a report from the review of the literature from the U.S. Department of Education that said there's almost no studies on K-12.
Well,
most of the stuff's been done at older kids.
There are studies of K-12.
But the studies that have been done are rather inconclusive.
I think that's fine. I mean, I think what we know...
But they do save a lot of money.
Yeah, I think that's hugely important.
So it's not about improving outcomes, it's about saving money.
Who said that?
Well, I'm asking you.
No, why don't you view it as a package? I mean, here we have a new approach to education that offers us a number of things, right? One of the things it offers us is a customized education for every child. This is an unbelievably wonderful thing that we have. It also allows us to substitute technology for labor in the process of education. Labor is unbelievably expensive, and education is unbelievably labor-intensive, and it always has been. And here, for the first time in history, we can substitute technology for labor and achieve the kinds of efficiencies and productivity gains that have been the key to success in every other industry throughout history. And education and a few other industries, mainly government-related things or Broadway plays or whatever, right? There are certain industries that haven't been able to take advantage of technology, and as a result, they just get more and more expensive over time, and it becomes more difficult for us as a society to really take advantage of them. But this way, we can get much more education for our buck. Or for a given level of bucks, we can get better education.
Now, if you look at the OECD numbers, comparative international statistics, American teachers are actually rather poorly paid. Whether you look at the dollars per hour they're paid for classroom time or relative to average incomes, and teachers in countries with very excellent outcomes that are respected by people around the world, like Finland, are very highly paid. You could argue that, you know, this is really an artisanal, complicated task, teaching kids, and that technology is not really an appropriate substitute for labor. We already spend more on machinery than most other countries do, and we're not getting a very good return on that, apparently. If you look at the international test results, Finland spends a lot less on technology and spends a lot more on teachers. How do you explain that difference in international comparisons?
I'm not sure what you're asking me. You started out by talking about how much teachers get paid, and you wound up by talking about technology.
Well, all right. I'm saying we spend a lot of money on technology and not much on teachers. Finland spends not much on technology and a lot on teachers.
Oh, we're hardly really spending anything on technology and education at this point.
Well, I'm talking about technology and education. I mean, this is OECD numbers. What can I say?
Okay. Well, right now, technology is a very minor part of American education. Right? Most kids go to school, they sit in a classroom, and they're taught by a teacher. That's the basic way education is carried out here and everywhere else. So I think we have to be very serious about money, because the schools are already getting, like in California, 40% of the budget. What? They're going to get 50%? 60%? They're not. They're just not. So how can we give our children a quality education without spending a lot more money, because we're not going to spend a lot more money. And technology is a big part of that answer. Plus, I think, fortunately, technology stands to be hugely productive. Kids can learn on the computer. They can learn math. They can learn English. They can learn chemistry, whatever. They don't need to be taught by a human being who's being paid a salary with benefits and all the rest. They can be taught by computers. Now, we still need teachers. So, see, what we'll have is a system in which teachers do other things. Right? They're tutoring one-on-one. They're taking care of problems as they arise. They're there to connect with kids, to monitor them, and so on. But we won't need as many teachers per student, and we'll rely more heavily on technology to do a lot, but not all of the teaching. And we'll just have to find a balance somewhere in the future. But this is all about teaching kids. It's all about children and what works out best for them, given the money that we have. It's not about saving teacher jobs, right? This is not, first and foremost, about teachers. It's not a labor issue, you know, and the public schools are not a jobs program. You know, this is about children and about educating children and finding the best ways to do that.
What do you think of the evidence presented, for example, by Nick Carr in The Shallows, that things we read on a computer, we understand less, remember less, and our comprehension and memory are severely compromised when we're reading on a computer compared to the printed page? Do you think that that has any bearing on the using technology more in teaching?
Certainly. Yeah. See, I think that this... See, I don't know how well that'll stand up over time, but... I think that kind of research, where we try to figure out what the best ways are of learning, period, right? Whether it's on a computer or from a human being, will shape what the balance is in the future. I mean, I would never say, oh, we should force kids to learn on the computer even if they're not learning as much, or even if the computer is bad at certain things. We should find out what computers are bad at, and then we should either make sure kids don't do that, or we should get really smart people to work on these things and make the computers better. See, and that's what's going to happen. It's already happening. There are lots of smart people streaming into educational technology. And the only thing that's keeping this market down is that there is political pressure by the unions and by the districts to make sure that technology does not advance, because it's threatening. It's threatening to jobs, and it's threatening to the district's money. So they want to control the whole thing, and that's keeping the market smaller. But they're going to fail long term. And as time goes on, this market is going to get bigger and bigger, and more smart people are going to come into it, and they're going to be developing better and better computerized programs for teaching.
What do you think of the Obama administration's race to the top so far?
Well, I basically like it, right? And I am very supportive of what they were trying to do. I mean, look, they're Democrats. They are constrained because the teachers' unions are at the heart of the Democratic coalition, have been for decades. They're huge contributors. They put a lot of people on the street during elections. They
so
are
the first union to endorse his re-election, I believe.
Pardon?
They were the first union to endorse his re-election.
Nice. They're trying to show that they're friends. They didn't endorse him during the Democratic primary in 2008. They endorsed Hillary Clinton. And they did not support his support for education reform. And they've been furious about Race to the Top, right? Because, and that's why I'm proud of him. I think that he and Arne Duncan stood up to the teachers' unions and said basically, look, we want more charter schools. We want teachers to be evaluated based on their performance. We want it to be fair, but we want them to be evaluated based on performance. We want to encourage pay for performance. And we want bad schools to be shut down and turned around. Right? All these things are things that the unions don't like and have fought against for decades. And Obama and Duncan stood up and said, we want to encourage these things, and we're going to do it. So I think they deserve accolades for initiating Race to the Top. Now, how it actually turned out was less impressive than I wish. And the whole union buy-in provision, I think, was unnecessary and unfortunate and a reflection of the fact that they're Democrats and they need to try to mollify the union somehow. But as Democrats, what they did was very unusual. And they stood up for kids, and they stood up for reform, and did things that the unions didn't like. That's unusual.
Earlier you mentioned that the teachers and charters work very hard. They don't work just a 40-hour week. They're in on Saturdays. I've seen some evidence that they work 60-hour weeks in a lot of cases. But this also leads to very high turnover. You get a lot of burnout, a lot of people who teach for a couple of years and say, I can't take this, and mm-hmm. move on to law school or something. Is that a good model to have a lot of young teachers who, so you don't really get a lot of experienced teachers? You want people, do you want to encourage that kind of turnover?
I think the proof of the pudding is in the eating. So I think that with KIPP schools and with most other schools, they are not wedded to one organizational form. And so if it turns out that what they're doing leads to bad teaching, they'll change it. I mean, they'll have incentives to change it. And I think that's the way it should be. I don't think anyone should be wedded to one organizational form. So having said that, the KIPP schools are doing very well at promoting student achievement. And if it turns out that kids come there, they're full of enthusiasm, and they teach for 3 years and leave, but nonetheless they're replaced by other kids who are full of enthusiasm and are doing a good job in the classroom, fine. There's nothing written in stone that says that teachers have to stay in their jobs for 35 years.
Generally, people get better at their jobs the longer they do it.
In teaching, they get better at their jobs until year 5, on average. And after that, it makes no difference. And so it turns out that all of the increments in pay that we're shelling out for teachers who have 20 years, 30 years experience, as though they're better than somebody who has 5 years experience, they're wasted because they're not any better on average. It is true, however, that the teachers in their first year or two, on average, across the whole country, are not as good as teachers who have had 3, 4, or 5 years of experience.
I happened to be reading some Thomas Jefferson education the other day, and he was very explicit in advocating different paths for what he called laborers and thinkers. And I can't shake the suspicion that a lot of these kinds of reform proposals are intended for the laborers, and the thinkers will go to different kinds of schools. For example, the president, for example, sends his children to Sidwell Friends, which is a very posh and expensive school. The children of Wall Street hotshots go to St. Anne's School in Brooklyn, $26,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
Is this really a kind of, management of the lower orders in an order effort to contain kids for 12 years, educate them cheaply, and then unleash them onto a job market where they're not expected to do very much. And whereas the children of the elite will continue to go to very progressive, very personalized, much lower tech kinds of schools.
Well, I don't know. You're laying it out as though it's some kind of grand capitalist conspiracy, you know, when it's not. You know, this is a system with 14,000 school districts. It's as decentralized as they come. You know, the feds have a hand in it. The states have, you know, 50 hands in it. It's a mess, you know, and in some important sense, nobody's really in charge of the thing. And it just is what it is, you know, and people pay taxes and the schools get funded and, you know, the schools aren't great, but some of them are great, but most of them are not. In the cities, they're terrible. And I think everybody wants them to be better, you know, but we're already paying a lot of money for what we have. I think that's the reality. I don't think it's some kind of capitalist conspiracy. And in any country where you have people that have a lot of money, they're going to just do what they want. You know, and unless you pass a law saying they can't do it, you know, and that's not going to happen. So I agree with you, you know, that the elites, they have better everything, you know, than the rest of us do. They just do, you know, that's just the way it is. And when people like you and I can't change that.
Well, there are ways to change that, but that's another conversation.
Well, it's not going to happen.
Thank you very much.
It is what it is. It's not going to happen because, you know, this is the USA where extremes of wealth and poverty are just part of the landscape like the Rockies. It's interesting, though, that money can buy a better education for the elite, but not poor kids, according to Terry Moe. We've been listening to Terry Moe, who's a professor of political science at Stanford and a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, a right-wing think tank where I spent the last week as a media fellow. Moe has been at Stanford for 30 years, apparently the five and out rule he liked to apply to public school teachers. Doesn't apply to him. People like Mo love to complain about all the rules in teachers' union contracts, but one reason for all the rules is that we treat teachers like cogs in a machine and not professionals. The labor management model is kind of like a car factory rather than an institution that's supposed to be about human development. And the approach of reformers like Mo is to make our schools more like a 2011 factory than a 1950s factory. More machines, speeding up the line, break the unions, cut the pay, make employment more temporary and more insecure. The approach of countries with better educational systems is completely different. Pay teachers better, require more training, make the field more selective, give teachers more autonomy. They're treated more like doctors than day laborers, the way we do it here. A few bits of fact-checking on some of Moe's assertions. On the Credo study of charter schools, which he cited, done by a group also based at Stanford, yes, they found a bounce back for second year, third year students, but that bounce back did not reverse the dip of the first year. The bounce back regained only about a third or half of the first year deficit. On balance, Credo found a very slight underperformance in charters versus traditional public schools, on the order of 2/100ths of a standard deviation, for those of you who follow these things, so small that it's barely worth mentioning. So my claim on the basis of that and several other studies that charter schools shown a significant difference in performance measured by the very imperfect benchmark of test scores show little difference from traditional public schools is correct. Moe's assertions to the contrary. A policy conclusion from this is that we're wasting a lot of effort on charter schools. We should instead be trying to figure out how to make the public schools that we have better. Charters often kick out underperformers or reject or discourage kids whose first language isn't English or have serious learning disabilities. As I mentioned in the interview, Jeffrey Canada's Harlem Children's Zone, the star of Waiting for Superman, kicked out an entire grade of students who weren't performing up to snuff. Traditional public schools can't do these things, so any gains that charters show must be read in that light. Studies of students transferring into charter schools show that they're often moving from traditional public schools that actually have better test scores than the ones they're transferring into. Mo dismissed my point that parents don't always know how to navigate the complicated and confusing world. He thought that I was being patronizing, but it's true. I don't think he has any idea how much is expected of parents in dealing with a system of school choice. We, meaning mostly my wife, spent a lot of time figuring out how where to send our five-year-old to kindergarten next fall in Brooklyn. We're both professional journalists with developed research skills, and she comes from a family of distinguished educators. It may not be rocket science, but it's not like choosing a detergent either. Several times, Mo touted KIPP. Knowledge is power, is what that stands for, a chain of charter schools. KIPP has a very long day. The school day typically runs from 7:30 to 5 and has students come in for half a day every other Saturday. I have nothing against longer hours for school kids, but that sounds extremely extreme. In March, a team of researchers at Western Michigan University looked into the KIPP story and found several interesting things. They conceded that the gains in test scores, again, a very flawed measure of performance, of course, they conceded those gains were real. But there are several typically undisclosed elements behind that story. One is that KIPP is very selective in admissions. Non-native speakers of English and disabled kids are about half as common in KIPP schools as they are in traditional schools. Second is that there's a very high attrition rate. A quarter or more of their students drop out, including about 40% of the black males. A third is they get large amounts of private money. Their revenue per student is about 50% higher than at traditional public schools. Moe's view of teachers is quite appalling. The day after we recorded that interview, the National Center on Education and the Economy issued a report written by its director, Mark Tucker, looking at what policies are pursued in educational systems far more successful than ours. Places like Finland, Japan, Singapore, and Shanghai. In those regions and countries, teaching is highly paid, and it's hard to get certified. Finland's education schools accept only about 1 in 10 applicants. In Shanghai, new teachers have to apprentice with master teachers during the early part of their careers. In all these places, teachers are quite well paid. Technology plays only a small role in those successful systems, and they don't drive teachers out of the field in 3 or 4 years. They treat them like the skilled professionals they are or should be. These countries are more interested in recruiting the most talented people to teaching and taking salary off the table in choosing professions, as Singapore's Minister of Education has put it, than they are in firing bad ones and closing bad schools, which is Moe's obsession. Surprisingly, we do spend a very large share of GDP on primary and secondary education, but as with our healthcare system, we have little to show for it. With education, we allocate that spending very badly. We spend more on the affluent and promising and less on the poor and the challenged, the opposite of what successful countries do. We spend a lot on machines, buildings, and administration, also the opposite of what the successful do. We test all the time, they only on occasion, typically 2 or 3 times in a student's career. Unions are prevalent in most of these places. There is no country in the world doing what we do, breaking unions, privatizing, instituting market mechanisms of competition into primary and secondary education. But since we're Americans, we don't want to learn from anyone else. And I do want to say, before I say goodbye, thanks to all those who pledged when I was here last week and throughout the fundraiser. And if you made a pledge, please make good on it. If you've already made good on it, well, double thanks to you. All right. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this stirring anthem, the Alice Cooper classic, as covered by the Donnas. Till next week. Bye.